Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days, and today we look at the crisis of accountability. One of the things that separates a democratic nation from a dictatorship is that its government is accountable to its electorate, both at the ballot box but also through other means. One of the major motivations for voting Brexit was a sense that this accountability was absent, and that perhaps that was down to the European Union. Indeed, this is Theresa May's assessment. On the 22nd of September, the Prime Minister made her landmark Brexit speech in Florence, Italy.
Is undimmed. Our determination to defend the stability, security, and prosperity of our European neighbours and friends remains steadfast. And we will do all this as a sovereign nation in which the British people are in control. Their decision to leave the institution of the European Union was an expression of that desire, a statement about how they want their democracy to work. They want more direct control of decisions that affect their daily lives, and that means those decisions being made in Britain by people directly accountable to them. The strength of feeling that the British people have about this need for control and the direct accountability of their politicians is one reason why, throughout its membership, the United Kingdom has never totally felt at home being in the European Union. And perhaps because of our history and geography, the European Union never felt to us like an integral part of our national story in the way it does to so many elsewhere in Europe.
It is a matter of choice. But what if this lack of accountability is not a crisis of the EU, but a crisis far closer to home? How will leaving the EU fix what's broken at home? Today we look at the crisis of accountability in Britain. Joining me today, we have Canary UK editor Beck Sumner, weekend editor Tracy Keeling, and Canary journalist Steve Topple. Welcome, team.
Hi. Hello.
Bex, let's start with you. You've spent around 18 months on the election expenses scandal, probably the biggest political scandal in the UK in living memory, and also given almost zero coverage of independent reporting outside of Channel 4 News and us. So what's happened? Can you remind people of the scandal itself and what the latest kind of movements are?
Yep. So, yeah, Election 4 has been back in the news again this week. The scandal itself, there's been so many different strands of it. There's been a whole strand of election fraud allegations around expenses and failure to declare expenses. And, you know, up to 30 Conservative MPs and agents were investigated by police forces across the country and the CPS. And there's been this other strand that we've been working on quite hard at the Canary, which is about telephone call centres, phone polling, yeah, as part of political campaigns in the run up to the general election. And Channel 4 did this fantastic undercover investigation. They put an undercover journalist into a call centre called Blue Telecoms in South Wales, mm-hmm, and they found some dodgy dealings going on. And those dealings triggered two investigations, one by the police and one by the Information Commissioner's Office. So it came back into the news this week because the Information Commissioner's Office made a ruling and they basically let the Tories off the hook. During election campaigns, political parties quite often use market research companies. They're trying to find out, you know, demographics of voters, and it's legitimate, it's allowed, mm-hmm, but it's strictly regulated. The Conservatives ploughed phenomenal amounts of money into telephone polling. Mm-hmm. It absolutely dwarfed what was spent by any of the other parties combined. And on camera, they caught, firstly, the people making the calls in the call centres pretending they came from an independent company and not mentioning that they were hired by the Conservative Party. Wow. They caught them, it's called, quote, push polling. They caught them working in negative messages about Jeremy Corbyn into their questions and positive messages about Theresa May. Yeah, it was all caught on camera. Channel 4 presumably passed it over to the Information Commissioner's office and the police. And the Information Commissioner's office ruled that what they did was unlawful, and that's a quote.
Yeah.
Parts of the campaign were unlawful, especially the messages that they were giving to voters. But it chose to give them a slap on the wrist rather than take any regulatory action. So yeah, there's been quite a lot of fury about this on social media, understandably.
Yeah, I can believe it, because you know the whole theme of this show is about the crisis of accountability that's happening in our system at the moment. But I mean, this is a phenomenal amount of work by, you know, the journalists involved primarily, because I mean, even we know from our experience of the research and the work we were doing when we were kind of contacting regulators, they didn't seem to be investigating this on their own. They were very much, oh, well, you know, hand us over your findings and we'll see what we'll do about it. So you've got, you know, a hell of amount of time and resource put in, you know, by journalists to uncover what is an enormous scandal. You know, we're talking here about a government winning an election by using unlawful means, and that's now not at dispute. That's the official finding. And the result is, don't do it again. No repercussions.
I mean, on the one hand, it's, you know, it's understandable. Yes, the Information Commissioner's office has a really narrow remit. It doesn't regulate election law. It just regulates electronic marketing. So on the one hand, understandable, fine. On the other hand, from a voter's point of view, like you say, where's the accountability? Because this isn't the first time. You know, we've had, you know, 14 police forces across the country investigating Conservative election fraud and failure to declare or wrongly declared expenses. They handed those files, you know, massive investigations, huge resources. They handed those files over to the CPS.
Yeah.
The CPS found that there were irregularities. They'd incorrectly declared expenses.
Yep.
But they couldn't do anything on a technicality, again, because they couldn't prove that they knowingly did it. The law is that they have to have knowingly done it, and they had no proof, so the CPS couldn't take it further. And again, you know, recently you had another case with the Electoral Commission. They fined the Conservatives £70,000 for multiple breaches in the way they were reporting election spending. I think it was in March this year. Again, they didn't have, you know, £70,000 is pennies to an election campaign. They can just cost that into the campaigns. So what it really, you know, each individual case, you're kind of like, okay, it's a technicality. Yeah, I understand. But the big picture is that we have a regulatory system that is completely failing democracy. You have, at the moment, we have party that all the evidence suggests it's really pushing boundaries. It's going right up to the boundary of the law and stepping over.
Yeah.
And that's been found again and again and again. But there's nothing anyone can do about it.
Absolutely.
And that raises serious questions about democracy.
You know, if you were sitting in Conservative campaign headquarters, you know, where would be the incentive not to do this again?
Yeah.
You know, this, yeah. I mean, you can kind of overlap it with the banking crisis, you know, and that kind of you actually now have, you know, banks and operators in the financial services industry actually, you know, calculating fines in to the business plan as just a risk assessment. You know, well, we'll do this, we'll take a hit here, but overall we'll profit. And I mean, you'd be making the same calculation if you were sort of a Machiavellian member of the Conservative campaign, because you'd just say, well, bottom line, you know, we scraped through the election. We're still in power. We haven't been toppled. You know, the media didn't rally behind us in Channel 4 News and drive this home in the same way as we did with the MP's expenses. None of the regulatory authorities or the legal system have stepped in to make this something for which the reaction was so punitive you would never even consider doing it again. It's just, well, kind of got through that, didn't we, lads?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it seems to be systemic because of the way regulation works in this country. You know, the regulators themselves are saying they don't have enough powers. The Electoral Commission has repeatedly asked for more powers from the government several times, very clearly. But at the same time, you know, where do regulators get their funding? Who's employed by the regulators? What's the revolving door situation going on between government and regulation? And the regulators very much know they exist at the whim of the government.
Yeah.
After the CPS said that the Conservatives wouldn't be prosecuted, the Conservatives span that as vindication. as it saying they were innocent. It wasn't. They said they did wrong. They just said they couldn't prove that they knowingly did wrong. Mm. Anyway, so the Tories threw their toys out of the pram and they just cracked down on the Electoral Commission. Tory MPs were calling for, quote, heads to roll at the Electoral Commission, quote, it was a witch hunt, quote, we need to abolish this incompetent organisation.
Yeah.
You know, it's not surprising that regulatory bodies stay cautious when they're looking at systemic abuse, or what seems to be to me systemic abuse. That's the picture I've built up after 18 months of looking at it. And then, you've got a media that's, you know, Channel 4 has been brilliant. The Mirror has been all right on this. The Mirror has been fairly good on this. But you've got the BBC existing at the whim of the government with a massive revolving door between them. We've got top academics from LSE saying the system is broken. British electoral system is wide open to corruption, fraud, foreign interference and abuse because the regulators don't have enough powers, and they're calling for an overhaul of regulation. And they're right, but who's going to do it?
Exactly, because the very government that would be responsible for doing it is benefiting from the status quo of fig leaf regulators. They use the regulatory system almost, as you said, to provide a defence for their misbehaviour, rather than having real teeth in those regulatory bodies to hold them to account at moments like this. It seems more like, when we're talking about systemic abuse, I mean, I'd include the regulators in that system.
Yeah.
It seems set up for failure, not set up for success.
Exactly. I should say there is one bit of good news. Well, for people who think the law has been broken and justice needs to be done, there is one bit of good news, which is that the Channel 4 investigation also spawned a police investigation. Yeah. So as part of their investigation, Channel 4 alleged that Blue Telecoms, the call centre, conducted, I quote, paid canvassing on behalf of Conservative election candidates, which is banned under election law. And this is actually an allegation that the Canary made publicly against Blue Telecoms in May 2016. Yep. And South Wales has now, is now running a criminal investigation, which it says is of scale and significance into that. And that's still ongoing. So who knows?
Well, we hold out hope. I really hope that some brave police service in Wales or somewhere actually stands up to this. Because I think the more times that they kind of get away with this stuff, it decreases public trust in those institutions. We've experienced this, when we've put out covering the story on election expenses, and you're getting reader feedback saying, well, so what? They're only going to get away with it anyway. Who cares? And it's almost like people become apathetic to the and resigned to the breakdown in accountability rather than motivated to do something about it. And I think that's probably a job for all of us as journalists. To kind of keep that motivation there with people to say, now's the time to be more on top of this, pay more attention to these issues, because it's only with that kind of public pressure that these things tend to shift. And there hasn't been anywhere near the public pressure, I don't think, instigated around this UK election expenses scandal that was needed to drive home some results.
Absolutely. Yep.
Thanks, Bex. So there was an opportunity here which was lost. This could and should have been a government-ending scandal. Governments have certainly fallen for less, but of course not during a crisis of accountability. So where else is the government shirking its responsibilities? Steve, you came across an astonishing letter from a Conservative MP, which simply beggars belief. It was on a topic that you've been investigating and covering now for the last couple of years. Do you want to speak to us about kind of what's happened?
Indeed. Okay. So as I seem to spend half my life writing about, we're back to the United Nations reports into the grave and systematic violations of disabled people's rights by successive governments in the UK. So, so the thrust of this was a constituent wrote a letter to Rachel McLean, Tory MP for Redditch, raising concerns about the UN inquiry, which found the government had created a human catastrophe for disabled people in the UK. Rachel McLean wrote back, and it was quite an astonishing letter. There's something more astonishing, which no one else knows about yet, which I'm going to break on this podcast in a moment.
Oh.
However, Rachel McLean wrote back and said, I note your serious concerns and strongly disagree with the conclusions reached in the report produced by the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. I cannot accept the report's conclusion that there is evidence of grave and systematic violations of the rights of disabled people, and the report fails to recognise all the progress that has been made to empower disabled people in all aspects of their lives. Now, bear in mind with this... I'm no fan of the UN. Let's make that clear for starters. I find them extremely flaccid, limp, unaccountable, if we want to talk about accountability, yeah. And also too slow to act on a plethora of worldwide issues. However, what's not been said about this UN report at all, really, in the media, is that it wasn't the UN as such saying this. This was evidence given by thousands and thousands of disabled people in this country to the UN.
Yeah.
So with one fell swoop, Rachel McLean is dismissing thousands of people who have given evidence to the UN in this country. But this is not the main issue with that. It's this constant denial and unaccountability of the Conservative government, and specifically Conservative MPs,
yeah.
about their responsibilities to disabled people. And it underscores that washing of hands that we're seeing yeah. by the Tories of their actions. I mean, there's been countless studies into this. We've reported on it quite often. The Oxford University linked 590 suicides to possibly the work capability assessment. They linked 250,000 increases in cases of mental health mm-hmm. and nearly 800,000 additional prescriptions of antidepressants. And this is just the work capability assessment. There's been report after report after report by the UN. There was four reports in 14 months, one from the UN Committee on Economic, Cultural and Social Rights, two from the Committee on the Rights of Disabled People, and one from the actual Human Rights Committee, and all of them condemned the welfare policies in this country. Not only the welfare policies, they condemned the government's lack of accountability regarding discrimination. The UNCRPD, the Persons with Disabilities Committee, specifically blamed the government and the media in playing a part in, and I quote, creating a view of disabled people as parasites,
yeah.
sponging off the government, living off benefits and being, quote, a burden to the taxpayer.
Yeah.
And this is not small fry evidence. These are really serious things. I think I've said this before on the podcast, but the first report by the Economic, Cultural and Social Rights Committee, the report was only comparable to that of Honduras, which both the US and UK governments have travel warnings in place for their citizens, because it's one of the countries with the highest murder rates on the planet. And our reports are only comparable to those. It keeps on coming back, this UN report, and it keeps on being bounced away and dismissed. I mean, I got a quote from an anonymous disabled person who's going to remain anonymous because they're involved in the UN inquiry and they don't want their names coming out.
Yeah.
But they said briefly that, with reference to the Conservatives, apart from clearly being in denial and a law unto themselves, McLean's government has totally dismissed the hard work and efforts of thousands of disabled people who shared their personal experiences with the UN. This was all whilst battling not only a massive rise in disability hate crime, but a vastly diminishing NHS. And it was on top of witnessing the loss of entitlements and safety nets originally given by a once proud Department for Health and Social Security. Its replacement, the DWP, now takes pleasure in burdening its claimants with bureaucracy, sanctions, and most recently a systematic attacked with the rollout of universal credit. As a disabled person, I'm left feeling I have no place in society, that I've become a subspecies under this current UK government, of which McLean is a part. Now,
damning words.
But this is all hyperbole and pie in the sky to the Conservatives.
Yeah.
And what I've just found out before coming to record this podcast is that this letter from McLean is not a first. I've been handed another letter from another Conservative MP to a constituent asking about the same question. It is a carbon copy of McLean's letter. What they're doing, they have a script, because when I wrote about McLean's letter, I thought, hang on, that sounds familiar to what Penny Mordaunt, the Minister for Disabled People, said in Parliament, and I checked
yeah.
back and it was nearly identical. I've now been
so this is a
letter.
Line. This isn't just a rogue MP. This is a party line.
Yep, they are trotting out a script, but all replies to inquiries about the UN report on disabled people in this country. And that itself just beggars belief.
God, that is disgusting. You've got thousands of people take part in this report absolutely damning findings. You know, people are going hungry, people are driven to suicide, people are just experiencing the most horrific isolation, including hate crime and social stigma. And the MPs are giving out pro forma letters concocted at Conservative HQ just to cover their butts.
Yep. It's like I said, they're running a script.
Oh, God, it's galling.
Yeah, I know. I literally, like I say, I only was handed this letter just before we started recording the podcast, so there will be an article coming on this, because it does just beg a belief that they think it's acceptable just to roll out a bloody standard reply to people over something so serious. But then, should we be surprised? Probably not.
I think not surprised, but I think we should be outraged. I think, you know, we're... Oh. That's really miffed me.
I know, right?
Take a breath. I'm
sorry,
actually fully angry.
just for the listener, Kerri-Anne Mendoza did not know about that before we started recording.
I did not. I'm actually shocked. It has shocked me. Just this whole thing, you know, I obviously, you know, we've been in the news ourselves recently, you know, with kind of media outlets, and we had the first Secretary of State, Damian Green, you know, saying awful things about us, you know, inciting this terrible anger that would drive people to go around killing their MPs, which was awful. I've put out an editorial on that. We'll put it in the show notes if you'd like to read it. And often people who have that argument about the work we do, the work that disabled organisations like DPAC do and others is, oh, you're fostering anger. Don't you appreciate, you know, can't you appreciate we are acting in good faith? You know, we are actually, we're not just evil. We're not just, you know, doing this for whatever. We are actually trying to make things better. And then you look at this and you say, how on earth is anyone supposed to believe these people are acting in good faith?
Yeah.
Really?
Exactly.
They're either so detached from the lived experience of disabled people in this country at the moment that they literally cannot believe this exists, which would make them criminally negligent. Or they do know and they don't care.
Yeah, exactly so. I think it's one of the crises of accountability of our age, the situation for disabled people in the UK, because for me, it underscores every other crisis, if you like. If governments are willing and able to treat disabled people like this, then there is no hope. There's literally no hope for anyone else. I get sick of writing about it. Once I've done this podcast today, I'm recording a video on universal credit with fabulous activist Paula Peters from DPAC, because the whole mainstream media narrative about universal credit is totally it's very shallow. They don't really understand what the deal is with universal credit, how serious it actually is, and the narrative is currently that telling horror stories about people on universal credit, which is good, but they're not really getting to the root of it. So I'm doing a video after this about it. So
fantastic. Well, I'm glad we've got you out there, Steve, doing that work. I know it's torturous for you some days and some weeks, but I think, you know, we need advocates. And the more and more powerful advocates we've got, I think the more chance we've got for making some moves on this and ending this crisis. Of accountability. And we're going to stay with you now, Steve, because there was another story that you covered in the last week which caught my eye. This was a letter from a train guard that had gone on strike, and it just cuts through kind of all the government's attempts to sidestep accountability for delivering a safe, affordable rail service. So could you just speak to that letter for a moment?
Indeed. What this also does, as a side note, is it underscores another point about the crisis of accountability, which ties in with the previous conversation about the UN report, which I'll come to at the end. But this letter from a train driver. So currently, there's a big uproar amongst the RMT union and the ASLEF union about what's known as driver-only operation trains. Currently, train operators like Southern Rail, Greater Anglia, Thameslink, which is part of the same company as Southern Rail, are rolling out these dual trains across their networks. Basically, driver-only operation is what it says on the tin. You lose guards on trains or conductors on trains, and it reverts to only having the driver who has the train companies claim enhanced CCTV, which means the driver can dispatch the train because they can see if people are trying to get on and off, they can see if there's any issues. So you only need a driver now, because the wonders of modern technology mean that the driver has 20 pairs of eyes and can see what's going on in every compartment of the train while watching the doors, while checking all his equipment in the cab as well. So they're rolling these out. There's been a massive hoo-ha. RMT have been striking for around 18 months now, specifically on Southern Railways. ASLEF have jumped on board. They've also been doing industrial action. And it's been interesting to watch. A lot of the media, especially The Guardian, has kind of been behind these strikes. I think it's because it's quite an easy, soft target for papers like The Guardian. They don't need to do much research into it. It's a fairly easy win. However, it's a far more complicated issue than the mainstream press would have you to believe. It's another one of these things that I've been like a dog with a bone with it. I've been banging on about. What did Ed Sykes, our global editor, call me? He called me the Canary's resident train spotter. because I'm on and on and on about this issue. But it's an issue which underscores so many other subjects. This letter from The Guard that I published summed it up really nicely. The letter, the thrust of it was saying that guards are not only there to clip tickets, they do countless other things as well, which people often forget. The two main takeaways from this letter were, firstly, regarding passenger safety. The driver quite rightly said that, for example, if in London, if someone is travelling on a train and they have a safety issue, for example, if someone is harassing them or they're being attacked or there's conduct by another passenger which they're concerned about, they are on average 2 minutes away from the next stop. And you know that if they press that emergency button, pull that emergency lever in a carriage, then the police will probably be there at that next stop 2 minutes away. What we're not talking about to do is the impact on services on Greater London and then outside of Greater London in rural rural settings. Quite often it's half an hour between stations. And the driver quite rightly said, as a guard, when someone was threatening towards a woman travelling alone, what were her choices? Get off the train at the next rural, partially lit station alone, panicked, or maybe try and find a friendly stranger to help? That friendly stranger, who would always be on the train in this case, was the guard. I removed her from that situation, called the police, and made sure she got home safely. This is not uncommon. These people are our daughters, brothers, grandparents. Again, another perfectly valid point which is not discussed. The lack of guards on trains could well increase safety issues for numerous subsets of passengers. There was a buried report last year which Transport for All, a campaign group in London, leaked, which showed that the police, Transport Police rather, have noticed an upsurge in crime on underground stations where there are no ticket officers anymore.
Surprise, surprise. Who could have possibly seen this coming?
Indeed. So this is one aspect which this anonymous guard wrote about. The other aspect, which is one that is the most critical in this, is access for disabled people to train stations. There's a real argument going on about this. You have the Association of British Commuters saying that the removal of guards from trains will breach the Equality Act 2010 because it will impede accessibility for disabled people to basically turn up and go at a train station. Because if you have no guard on trains and it is an unmanned station, then there is no one to assist the disabled person on getting on and off the train. Now, the train companies are running legislative rings around this, saying they offer a service where disabled people can phone up 24 hours in advance and book for assistance, and it will be there at the station.
Yeah, but you don't always know you're going to travel 24 hours in advance.
I just paused for an intake of breath there. Because this is something else which just beggars bloody belief, that in 2017, someone in an office at Southern Rail, someone in an office at the Department for Transport, thinks that it's effing acceptable that disabled people are unable to just arrive at a train station and get on a train. Yeah. How is this even acceptable?
Oh, yeah.
Why are we even having this conversation that disabled people, well, if you want to get a train, you have to book 24 hours in advance, and we know it's 2017, but come on, you're in a bloody wheelchair, what do you expect? It really hurts my head that this is somehow acceptable, and we should just take this. I do bloody understand. I understand exactly what it is, but I don't understand if that makes sense. It beggars belief. And this is an argument which is underscoring this whole debate about do trains. The Association of British Commuters made it part of a legal action against Southern Rail and the Department for Transport back in June.
Yeah.
2 days before the case was to come to court, DfT backed down and they fined Southern Rail 13 million quid to get out of having to present evidence of why they are correct in, firstly, this policy regarding disabled people, and secondly, the unaccountability that they have shown towards the franchising of these train lines to Southern Rail. It underscored that action. Secondly, it's bubbling up again because there's currently an independent investigation by the National Audit Office being commissioned about the blurring of lines between the train industry and the Department for Transport. That investigation is ongoing. It's due to be out next month. But the access issue underscores that as well. And like I said, the ABC are claiming that government and train companies are breaching the Equality Act 2010 with this. So, but this letter kind of summed up, if you like, the detachment between train companies, the DfT, and the people who actually work on trains. This guard is making himself fully accountable for what he does. Yeah. It was an open letter saying that we do this, we do that, we think this is important, we know we don't often always get this right, we know there's issues here. Complete accountability from a lowly down the pecking order train guard.
Yeah.
And he showed more accountability in one letter than the train companies and the DfT have showed in any of their interactions, quite frankly.
That's absolutely phenomenal. And just for listeners to know that if you go to the show notes on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast, we'll have a link to all of the stories from today, including Steve's, so you can actually read that in full. I would advise you to. It's an extraordinary letter, and I think goes, as Steve says, you know, it shows that, you know, this isn't a crisis of humanity. You know, there are still plenty of incredible human beings out there that are happy to be accountable and take pride actually in providing a decent service, a safe service and a quality service. And it's about dealing with the systemic issues that are actually preventing those people from kind of delivering on that task. So thank you for both of those stories, Steve.
Okay.
And last but most definitely not least, we come to Tracy. So we opened on Brexit and we're going to close on Brexit. Tracy, this is a story of yours that actually went out in August, but has suddenly started to pick up a lot of traffic again. And it's about a chilling detail that was sort of found buried in Theresa May's Brexit plans. So we thought, as it seems to be something that people are wanting to talk about again, we'd include it in today's show. So what's there, Tracy? What's the detail?
It's about citizens' abilities to hold their government to account post-Brexit, because the Times reported that we are going to lose our ability, potentially, to sue the government for breaking the law post-Brexit. That's a right that we have under EU law since 1991, after what's known as the Frankovic ruling. We've been able to sue the government for damages if they fail to uphold EU law, which of course is what we're covered under currently. Yeah. But there's a clause in the Great Repeal Bill, apparently, which reads, there is no right in domestic law on or after exit day to damages in accordance with the rule of Frankovic. A government spokesperson, however, following this this discovery, a government spokesperson said, you will still be able to sue the government, individuals will still be able to receive damages and compensation. They're just saying it won't be in relation to Frankovic, but there's no evidence essentially being given as yet to confirm that. So the Great Repeal Bill itself, of course, has the so-called Henry VIII powers, which the Great Repeal Bill is meant to transfer EU law into UK law, but it's not going to be an automatic like-for-like transfer because the Henry VIII powers can potentially be used to not bring over or change certain things. So there is the potential for us to lose certain rights that we currently have just because of those powers, those executive powers, if they remain, if they stay in it. It can be on a number of different things, of course. So it could be air pollution and the standards that we're not upholding generally have been in the news a fair amount lately. So we could lose the ability to hold our government to account on that. Workers' rights are a big question mark over workers' rights for Brexit and whether they'll all be transferred like we have now. And by workers' rights, of course, we mean the ability to have holiday, the ability to have sick pay, all of those
things. Yeah, the weekend.
Business regulations. And it also potentially also could apply to past or present. So that's an unknown as well. I should also say that, there is this question of trust, of what Brexit is actually doing, like who is it helping? And, as we see, it may be helping the government to not be accountable to its citizens rather than...
Absolutely. And I think it is a matter, as a citizen, of not just listening to people's words, but looking at their actions.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that frustrates me about Brexit, partly because it's just become such a hyper-partisan issue in the sense that you either have to be absolutely in love with the European Union and have zero criticism. It's fantastic and we should remain and there's no grey areas at all. Or you have to be absolutely committed to Brexit, and damn the EU to hell and everything is going to be fine and all of these stories are just scaremongering. And it's just like the truth is neither. Neither of those things are true. There are absolutely justified criticisms about the way that the European Union operates. And that's okay for us to have that conversation and remain or leave. And ditto with Brexit. I think it's entirely possible that Britain could Brexit from the European Union and do very well over time. But all of that is going to depend on how we exit, what we set up for the future. And I don't know about you, but I can't see anything happening right now that is delivering on any of the key promises made to people who voted Brexit. There's nothing, even if you're anti-immigration, there's nothing on immigration. There's not that £350 million business, that's all gone by the wayside. There's not going to be increased funding for the NHS. We're having, in terms of taking back control, how's that project going? We're potentially losing rights to hold the government to account that we already have. So we'll have less control.
They, our arbiters of, our new freedom, are hiding information from us on Brexit even.
Yeah.
Like there's 50 reports apparently, or thereabouts, that they have done, that they potentially have hold of, which are all about the impact of Brexit on, different facets of our country and different industries. And nobody's allowed to see them apart from the government. So it's not just even the rights, it's that, the power of information that we should be given and we're not.
I do find it ironic. I know we've touched on this before, but the irony is it's so rich, it's slapping you in the face, is that I remember that the idea of a left-wing exit from the European Union, what they call Lexit, was sort of predicated on the idea that you'd, kind of pull away from neoliberalism that's happening in the European Union, particularly, the TTIP trade deal. And all of the things that would bring with it in terms of the assault on workers' rights, the rights of corporations to sue the state, and it's endless. the impact, you know, deregulating kind of food standards and agricultural standards and so on. And that was almost kind of the biggest reason the left could find to vote for Brexit, was the idea that we could sidestep TTIP and make those decisions more locally. And then you look like a year or so down the line and TTIP is dead in the water, it's gone. You know, wouldn't have that threat from remaining in the EU. And basically the Brexit deal and the trade deals attached to it seem to be TTIP on stilts.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, we are at the amount of... It's a rare speech these days by a government minister that doesn't extol the virtues of free trade. That's like, we will be the pioneers of, you know, people loving free trade again.
Yeah.
That's definitely what they see in our future. The other thing with, you know, seeing as we're talking about rights and, you know, what you could have had with Brexit, like, you know, there are fundamental rights, so the right to privacy and those sorts of things. Yeah. They are generally more protected within the EU than out of it. Our human rights as a whole, as we covered before, this government wants to scrap the Human Rights Act. Obviously, they say they're going to replace it, but then again, will it be a like for like replacement?
Mm.
So yeah, there's a lot to lose, just in general, unless we, you know, are very careful about making sure the government, you know, respects the need for us to have those rights and tells us about it, is accountable to us and listens to us.
I think actually, Tracy, what you're underscoring is almost the point of this entire show, which is that inside of a crisis of accountability, which is clearly systemic, you know, it's across all of our kind of institutions and regulatory bodies, all of the kind of almost like all of the people that should be in charge, that actually should be making these things work, are not. And so rather than pulling away, actually, we need to be leaning into it and actually seizing accountability for ourselves. Like, it's really on us to pay ever greater attention, to get ever more involved in these things, because the more we pull away, the more resigned that we become to these things. I mean, it's just, it makes their lives easier because they go, great, we love your apathy, we love your resignation, we're just going to crack on with our project to asset strip your state. So it is actually... ultimately, I think, going to come down to each and every one of us being involved and paying the kind of attention and applying the kind of pressure that changes the world. So thank you. Thank you, Bex. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Tracy, for your stories today. I'm sure the listeners have had quite a lot of food for thought there. And that's us done for another week at Canary Pod. So please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. And make sure you subscribe and review Canary Pod on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to us on. It helps more people to find us and listen in too. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.